Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. This week, I spoke with Karisten Konen, a professor of psychiatric epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, about mental health fatigue, the holidays, and building resiliency during the pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic, as we all may know, is taking a serious toll on our mental health. So striking, a CDC survey conducted in June found that 40% of adults in the U.S. are now struggling with mental health or substance misuse. And that includes at least 1 in 10 respondents who reported having seriously considered suicide over the last month. Even more troubling, these percentages are greater for people of color, for young adults, caregivers, and essential workers. At the same time, many of us are also experiencing pandemic fatigue. And this timing couldn't be worse, as COVID-19 cases are surging and don't appear to be letting up in the United States. So on top of that, we have the holidays coming up. Many people will be coming closer together in close quarters and dealing with that mixed emotions about meeting or not. So it's all a lot. And so today we'll be talking about all of these things and with you how to build resilience, how to manage the holidays. And to begin, Karisten, we spoke in the spring, actually, about a lot of these signs that mental health may be a big challenge in the coming months. And I wonder if you can give us a picture of how this is playing out, of how the pandemic has impacted mental health so far.
Sure, Alana. So when we met in April, I think it was, we predicted, or many people are predicting, a mental health crisis in addition to the pandemic. And I think, unfortunately, the data has actually borne a lot of that out. So at that time, we didn't know, but that's what we saw coming. And you mentioned the CDC study. There's been a number of other studies, and colleagues published something in JAMA Network Open, which showed that not only are there more cases of anxiety and depression, sort of like clinical depression, anxiety disorders, but that the whole population, the whole community, we've sort of become more depressed. So there's more depressive symptoms, and there's more people who may not qualify for being depressed or actually meet a doctor's diagnosis, but they're experiencing some symptoms of depression, anxiety. You mentioned also, thoughts of suicide. And I think it just speaks to the ubiquity of the pandemic and the issues. And then in terms of, I don't even know if we have to talk about why. There's so many reasons why that is, in addition to the threats of the virus, worries about getting sick. In addition to that, we've had incredible turmoil in this country in terms of awakening around racial justice and issues related to that. There's still millions and millions of people unemployed. Stimulus benefits have run out. So there's just sort of been a pounding of stressors that are the pandemic itself and then all the things that have stemmed from the pandemic, in addition to other things going on.
This may seem like a very straightforward question, but when you say as depressive symptoms in the community, what do you mean by that?
That's a good question. So depressive symptoms are things like feeling down, feeling blue, where it persists over days or weeks. It's not just temporary. Being unable to sleep, having trouble concentrating, not really getting pleasure in things you used to get pleasure in. So maybe in April or May or June, you like going for walks or whatever, or certain things, but the things even that you used to enjoy, you're not enjoying anymore. So those are some of the depressive symptoms. And I think people are just experiencing more of those. Even if they don't, necessarily aren't going to be diagnosed by a doctor with depression.
You mentioned that we're seeing this kind of predicted kind of crisis play out. And one of the things, for example, in hospitals, you know, there has been this push to scale up their capacity. Has there been a similar thing happening amongst mental health specialists and the system as a whole to really scale up the services and the responses?
I think, so the answer is yes and no. So in the sense of, I would say the mental health community broadly has really tried to respond. And in ways, for example, clinics have gone from being in person to online. Insurance carriers moved from not covering virtual visits. It was very hard to get phone or video visits covered. They've moved to coverage, to having to cover that. That's enabled providers to keep seeing patients from home or see new patients. The amount of resources that I've put out there, some my group has done, but sort of every organization, American Psychiatric Association, Psychological Association, has put out a massive amount of resources, information, webinars, treatments, different apps have, like Headspace and things, have offered, you know, free memberships. So there's been sort of a, from the ground, like grassroots, there's been this incredible sort of outpouring. But unfortunately, we haven't had anything from the top down. So there hasn't been any national or even, you know, really major statewide, as far as I've seen, policies to scale up. So it's really been at the individual provider or clinic level where people have, you know, reached out and tried to you know, increase access. I have also heard that waiting lists have gotten longer at clinics. One of my colleagues works in, you know, so that is, and they're increasingly getting longer, both reflecting the increased demand for people for services. But it's not like we produce more providers during this time. So I think one of my colleagues, Vikram Toy Patel, always says, in terms of mental health, every country is a developing country. So I think that, you know, we are hitting some of that, that sort of wall we have with capacity, which is going to take bigger. It's sort of, I know there's bigger things that need to be addressed there.
There's two follow-up questions I have on that. One is, what would be the role of like state or federal policies? Like, do you see that as being, what would that look like? And are you saying that from, as you see this play out, that that's going to be needed? So yeah, we'll start with that.
Okay, sure. And I will say that I'm, you know, I'm an epidemiologist and psychologist, not a policy person or an economist. But if I had to choose one intervention to improve the mental health of Americans, I would say Congress needs to pass a stimulus package. The number one thing that can be done is to have people get to get people back to getting unemployment benefits and protect people in their homes, because those are two things we know. When people lose income and they lose their homes, that increases mental health problems. So that is that would be number one. And then I think there are a lot of people, a lot of the smart policy people, there are things like, for example, that gets in the way of capacity is not being able to see patients across state lines. So if I'm licensed in Massachusetts, I can't see a patient in Texas, let's say. And so there's those kinds of challenges which need to be addressed at a higher level that I think could increase capacity, especially places where you're not going to necessarily increase the number of providers in the state or in the area, but you could. I think one of the positives that's come out of this is the comfort and the use of telehealth and people reporting that it's been effective and useful. And so we could.
That surprises me. I was curious how effective virtual is in place of the in-person connections or
Well, actually, and interestingly, the Veterans Affairs, Department of Veterans Affairs, has actually done quite a lot of research on this, on veterans, on treating veterans in person and virtually, because obviously there's a healthcare system that provides evidence-based care, but has to do it, you know, across a lot of geography. And there's a lot of evidence that telemedicine for mental health can be as effective as in person. I think there's, you know, there's like finer points on exactly which treatments and what the, you know, the challenges are. If you can't, you know, if you don't have good internet, then it's going to be challenging to use it. Obviously, you're going to have to be able to see a provider on video. But yeah, so there actually is evidence, and certainly the individual providers have reported that their patients have been able to come, and some who've seen kids have said it's actually been a little easier because parents aren't having to, like, you know, get them into the office and things. So I think there could be a lot of positives there.
You mentioned Vikram Patel and kind of this global connection. And I wonder what you're seeing here in the United States, you also do research globally. And I'm wondering what you're hearing from colleagues about how this mental health trend is, what you're seeing globally.
I think that one of the things that's been striking to me is how consistent the reports are globally from now there've been, now we have published data. We didn't have this in April from Europe, a lot of work in Italy, from China, from South America. We have there's a lot of work out there. And, you know, every report I've seen has reported increased rates of anxiety and depression, which is what people study. And then some, you know, substance use where they've looked at that. Where we've done, we did a global pregnancy survey and of pregnant women. And what we found was that the countries we had the highest responses were US, Mexico, China, and South Africa. And what was remarkable was the high levels of depression, anxiety, and loneliness as well across all the countries. So I think what's striking is what we're seeing is it seems consistent. I mean, time will tell whether that holds up and whether those things persist over time or in some countries they're, you know, they're mitigated.
There's questions coming in.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But I do want to get to this follow-up. You know, winter is also coming and there is this growing research showing that around the globe, there are growing trends in depression and anxiety and these sort of things. So what are your suggestions for managing that? And in particular in places like the East Coast that are delving into winter months where maybe some ideas of exercising outside or mm-hmm. meeting people outside or doing things may be happening less.
Right. Yes. And I'd love to hear other people's ideas myself. I mean, I would say, first of all, I'm going to say it's really hard. And in my own family, we're figuring this out for Thanksgiving and what to do. And so some of the things I'm going to be personal about the things that have been helpful to me, because I can say that it's also a struggle on my end some days. One thing is that we had the news about Moderna and Pfizer about vaccine efficacy. And so I try to remind myself that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. When we spoke back in April, we really didn't know, but that we actually, I do think that we have a lot of reason to believe that this will be much better by the summer. So it's gonna be a hard few months. So that helps me to remind myself, this is not forever. It feels really crappy, but this is not forever, it's today. And then the other things I think that people can find helpful around the holidays is I've been trying to rethink it and try to, for example, been looking into opportunities to deliver meals on Thanksgiving, because Thanksgiving is my personal family's favorite holiday. It is the huge holiday where we're together and we can't do that this year. So thinking about ways that I could give back that might make me feel better and actually be helpful. And then I think but at the same time, just recognizing that it's going to be hard and that's okay. And thinking about creative ways you can still do some of the things that maybe you used to enjoy. Are there games you can play online, making time to talk to your relatives, especially for me, like it's my mom. 70s in Atlanta, and I won't have seen her for a year. The other challenge families are facing, and my own family is facing, is we lost loved ones this year to COVID, and the last time we were all together was Thanksgiving. And so I'm sure, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of people around the country who are facing the same thing. And I think one of the things we're trying to do is to acknowledge that loss and making time to talk about people. And actually it's I'm gonna say it feels better, but it feels more authentic to acknowledge the grief than to sort of pretend like, oh, it's all fine. And I think that would have been hard anyway, losing those people and getting together, but it's, you know, it's just gonna be more challenging this year.
Well, first, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
This actually transitions into a question about bereavement from online, which is, I mean, what can people do who are struggling with grief when the rituals are off limits? And you spoke about some of this, but it's really disrupted end of life rituals too. And I mean, again, in the United States, there's been more than 200,000 deaths.
Right. So it is really challenging. I would say the loss of my family, we actually never had a formal funeral memorial because, you know, for lots of reasons. But so some of the things, I think if you can make the time to, it's not going to be the same as the rituals, but some of the things we've done is make time to get online with family members and talk about and share memories about those that have lost. Now in normal life, we would do that in person. People would visit or you'd have a memorial, but just even having, you know, on a Sunday afternoon or kind of getting on FaceTime or Zoom and just talking about that, that has helped a lot. People, you know, so old school to write letters and stuff anymore, but to write about, look at pictures, share pictures with a family member or someone you're with, all that kind of stuff to spend the time remembering and letting the emotions come and sort of experiencing them can, you know, that is something you can do. And then I think the other thing is you could think about planning something, some kind of acknowledge it in the future. And that's something we're talking about. And obviously that's sort of not known when that future will be, but, you know, again, we're not going to be in this forever. And so there will be a time when perhaps you can come together and acknowledge that.
Thank you for that. Yeah. And for sharing about your own kind of experiences. Yeah. This question's from Amber. There's two questions, but, I think in kind of moving towards kind of emotions, dealing with anger and sadness, right now, she has two questions, or parts of a question. One is like, how do you deal with these emotions, for example, with anger and sadness? And in this case of seeing others live semi-normal lives while you're trying to be careful. And then the other part is like, how do you overcome like the anxiety or the anxious brain when every single thing you pick up could have, like, you could spread COVID to somebody who's vulnerable, even when masking, feeling like there's just this really infectious disease around us.
Mm-hmm. Those are really good questions. So I would say the first thing, and it sounds like Amber's already done this, is you need to acknowledge and recognize the emotions you're having. So you are feeling angry and you're feeling angry at the people, whatever, outside. I mean, I see a field and sometimes I see people congregating, like, what are they doing? So acknowledging the emotions. And I think the other piece is really being aware of how you're taking care of yourself. Because if you're sleep deprived and super stressed from other things and not eating right and not getting exercise, you're going to feel anger and anxiety more, that the way you take care of your body is related to how you feel emotionally and vice versa. So although things like what you eat and, you know, taking a walk may not seem like they're helping you manage the emotions, they are, absolutely. And then I think in terms of anger, you know, the other things you can do is, you know, spend some time with it yourself, like journaling or, you know, whatever, if you do something creative, and personally I do journaling, and trying to figure out like, where maybe there is a place you can do something about it, that you need something you need to address, and where is it you kind of just need to process it. So, you know, perhaps there's someone in your life who isn't being safe and you're worried about them and you're also angry at them and you need to think about how to approach them versus, just sort of, you know, anger at the world or at the situation, which there's not going to be, you know, there might not be an action you can take. So I think taking some time to kind of figure that out can be helpful.
This is a question from online. What do we know about the long-term effects of the pandemic on kids' mental health? Mm-hmm. Do you think there's going to be some sort of psychological imprint on a whole generation? And what can families and caregivers do and with promoting that resilience?
That's a great question. I think, you know, we don't know. From what we're learning, I think the effects on kids' mental health are so highly variable by their context and their age. And the exact struggles they're having. And so much for younger children, so much depends on how their family and caregivers are doing. And then for older kids, like I have a young adolescent and adolescents, there's different issues because, you know, they, you know, honestly, they're not supposed to be with their parents 24 hours a day. So they're going a little, you know, crazy about that. So I think it very much depends. And also I think there is a question, I've thought about this myself because I have a 13-year-old, is how will this affect the way they think about health and, you know, the world and everything. So I think there are a lot of open questions, I guess I have, and I would imagine it will have some imprint on them. It may not all be negative. One of the things I've seen with my son who's 13 is it, like he wears a mask, no problem. He sort of has this growing understanding of health as something we share as a community, not as something that's just up to an individual. And I sort of wonder if this generation will have that. And that actually could be a really positive thing. And then in terms of how to help kids, we do have something in the resources that'll be that are posted. We have a session on kids on our forum, and there are some specific things about kids. I think one of the things to remember with kids is that they can like they have really good truth detectors, are like, you know, so they thinking about their age and what you can share with them in terms of how, you know, old they are and what they'll understand, but they don't believe you if you just say everything's fine and things aren't. So navigating the sharing information and not being overwhelming with being genuine is really important. And then also for parents, you know, I'm a working mom with a kid. It's really hard right now. There's a lot of evidence that people with kids at home and women especially are suffering. There is truth. It's so hard, but there is truth in that, you know, a lot of how well your kids manage their stress will be, they'll be watching you. And so they're really important for parents to figure out ways, parents and caregivers to figure out ways to take care of themselves, is really, really important.
You mentioned things like for you that's helped is journaling, taking care of your body and that sort of thing. This question from online, just to clarify, like, are there, what kind of tools can, you've learned to be more resilient?
Oh yeah. Okay. I said, it's funny. My 13-year-old was home. He would be laughing at, he's really prompt to show me when I'm not resilient. So anyway, that's been very humbling. So some of the tools I have found, I'm been traditionally quite into yoga. So I try to do a yoga class or two a week online. They're actually, those resources are massive out there, including free resources. And once you pay for, I mean, you can practice with teachers, famous teachers all over the world. I use an app called Insight Timer, which is a meditation app. It has sleep meditations. It has free courses on mindfulness and you know, all kinds of stuff like that. So I use that. I also, I have a dog, so I make sure I get out and exercise. I have to the dog every day. So those are some of the things I do. And the other thing I do, which is a little strange to say in this conversation, is that I do try to practice turning off the news, like podcasts, my Twitter. I will confess, I took my Twitter app off my phone for a while, that kind of thing, because I have found that I need to take a break from all that sort of stuff coming in. And then actually a fourth thing I just did was I just attended a free online program on the Monet exhibit at the MFA, which is the Museum of Fine Arts. And that was fabulous. It's like, I looked at videos of Monet online, and that's not a normal thing I make time to do, but there are a lot of things out there like that, free concerts and things. And so trying to bring something into your life that is like feed your soul, I think is really important. It's challenging, but really important.
Are the things, this is from online, and there are some like more kind of trend and questions that I have, but just because we're on this thread, there's a lot of questions coming in and follow-ups. Yeah. One is, are there things that to build resilience that are the same for stress relief, or are there different things?
Oh yeah, I think actually a lot of the things that you build for stress relief are build resilience too. I think of resilience, and it's sometimes it seems like this sort of, it's hard to get your hands on what it means, but I like to think of resilience as a capacity that we can build with practice. And like anything, and what I mean by practice is that we can build it in small steps over time. So, you know, going for a 5-minute walk, closing your computer and sitting and breathing for 5 breaths, all of that manages your stress and builds resilience. So it's even those small things. And the analogy that I've taken this from someone, it's not my analogy, but is that if you think about something like a sailboat, if you move the rudder just a little bit, if you shift direction just a little bit in the present, you'll be in a different place in the future. So even these small things, which may not seem like, they may not seem like, oh, they're not going to change your life today, can have a big impact over time.
And I guess from the clarifying the question, those same things are good tools for stress relief.
Yes, they manage your stress and they build resilience. I would say they do both. Yes, absolutely.
How do you, just one more on this thread, this is from online. What if you feel like you don't have the energy to be resilient right now? And you mentioned the sailboat metaphor, but how do you give yourself the mental space to feel badly without sinking into like a full-on depression?
That's, yes, that is hard. So I think it is, I think right now that we have to, it's a balance, of acknowledging that things are hard and not, you know, pretending like not deluding yourself that they're not, and whatever, everyone's heart is different. Some people lost loved ones. Some people have sick people they're taking care of. They lost their jobs. So acknowledging those things are hard. And then to consciously choose to do things that are going to improve your mood. When we treat depression, like in the clinic, there's something we call behavioral activation. And basically part of that is just like, if you're feeling bad, often you don't want to do things that are going to make you feel good. So what we have patients do is make a list of things that make them feel good. And they're actually like assigned them for homework. So some of it is making yourself do things that, you know, might make you feel better from the past. Right now, you don't believe it right now, like nothing's going to feel good, but making yourself do it anyway. And often that will help a bit with your mood. And if nothing else, again, if it's something physical, like going for a walk, if nothing else, it will give you some exercise. But there's lots of evidence that exercise actually helps with depression. So that's some of it. It's actually really, it's a challenging time. It's a really challenging time.
This question comes from the World's Facebook page. Yeah. Now that we're in a kind of fall surge, like in 1918, are there lessons from mental health perspectives that we can learn from that period? Or even from, I would expand that to other outbreaks or pandemics of the past?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's actually a great question to look into in terms of if we know from pandemic. So I guess the first thing that occurred to me when you were talking about that was that we know it will end. So the 1918 pandemic was horrible and it ended. Ebola, SARS, they didn't become pandemic. They were more localized epidemics. Horrible for the communities that experienced them. They did end. So I guess one thing we can learn is there will be an end. We will not be in this forever. Keep our eye on that. Secondly, what we learned from, I know from more of the recent epidemics, is we learned quite a lot about, for example, how to protect the mental health of people in quarantine, which is to provide, to make sure you provide really good information about how long they'll be in quarantine, what people need to do. Some of the other lessons we learned from those we haven't been great at applying. So for example, having really good, accurate information helps people feel less anxious. And unfortunately in the US, we've had such mixed information, complicated information, that has only increased people's anxiety. So I think that those are some of the lessons we learned. The other lessons we learned from previous, from I know from Ebola and I think SARS, is that people who've experienced these conditions, and we're seeing this with COVID, have some increased mental health problems themselves. And that needs to be understood, but also that some of the mental health consequences can linger for a while. There were people who went back to communities that were affected by Ebola and found elevations in depression, anxiety, PTSD, even a year later, which just tells us that it is, once the pandemic's over, we will still likely have to address some of the mental health impacts. They won't magically resolve when the pandemic's over.
Yeah, researchers, there was a Lancet Psychiatry study that found that something like 1 in 5 COVID-19 survivors were diagnosed with a mental health condition, mm-hmm. like anxiety, depression. And so from that, what do you think can be done to better support patients during their illness and recovery? And then I guess, always have more questions, but add on for health workers too.
Yeah, that's a great, those are great questions. So I think number one is just, and we are in a better place with this, providing better information about how the virus is spread and how you can protect yourself. We actually didn't know that in March and April, and we actually know that now. I mean, I know hospitals in Boston, the ones I'm aware of, have had zero community transmission. So, meaning transmission in the hospital, and that wasn't true in the spring. So making sure that people have good information and have all the equipment. So providing things like, you know, making sure places have adequate PPE and adequate staffing, and then that the patients are given good information and that, and their family members are given good information. And then something that was really important for my own family when we had relatives who died of COVID in March, and again, different situation then, was that in that case, we were able to FaceTime my brother-in-law's parents. He was able to FaceTime with them, and the nurses were actually really amazing in letting them communicate with the family, even though they were isolated and obviously no one could visit. And so I think paying attention to those things is really important. But one of the ways we can best serve our patients is to protect our healthcare workers and just to make sure that they have what they need and to listen to their needs.
Do you have any advice about healthcare provider burnout or any advice about that?
Yeah, it's really challenging. I guess the two things I would say about that is one, that it really needs to be addressed by the institutions. And I think institutions have stepped up more. And that once for healthcare workers themselves, once they we get through this next surge, I mean, they may not have much choice in terms of having to work a lot. Once we get through this next surge, that institutions provide ability to take time off or resources to, if they need treatment, whether it's employee assistance program or other kinds of accommodations, parental leave, these kinds of things, that those things be provided to them so that they can sort of recover from this. One thing that is being reported in some of the surveys we're doing is what's being evidenced is the resilience of healthcare workers. We expected to see much worse mental health outcomes. And this is not to say they're not stressed and burnout and suffering. It's just that been amazed actually at how resilient the providers are.
We just have a few minutes left. Yeah. So a few more questions. Yeah. What advice do you have on cultural specific mental health tools, given the disproportionate impact, for example, of mental health on minority communities?
Wow, that is a really good question, which could probably be its own session.
Have been some topics.
So there's been some topics on that. So I would say that the one resource people can go to is the resources that are provided by the World Health Organization, their mental health resources. And the reason I'm pushing people there is because since people who are listening to this might be from all over the place, all over the world, is they have a number of resources and tools which are for specific communities in different languages, also globally. So I think that is really important. And then the other piece around that is to also, look at services at places like in Boston, I would say Boston Medical Center, places that are oriented towards treating diverse communities, because they're much more likely to have providers who provide culturally competent care. That's my sort of short answer, but it's a longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to wrap up now, because we're about out of time, okay. Are there places around the globe you've seen that have been doing some things well in addressing this?
That's a good question. There's certainly places around the globe, for example, Kenya is one where there has been a attention at the national level to sort of national mental health plans around COVID. So there are places that have done that. We'll have to see over time how well that's implemented. I think that this might surprise people, but I really think that places, for example, countries in Europe that have provided a safety net for people in terms of their income, their job security, their healthcare, and their housing have, I'm not sure this was the intention, but they have probably, that I would predict those things have mitigated worse mental health outcomes or prevented worse mental health outcomes. We'll see. So I'm sure someone will do that analysis, one of my colleagues, but because if you can really buffer people from the economic consequences, that will buffer them from some of the negative mental health consequences. We know that for sure.
So finally, you have offered some kind of glimmers of hope throughout this conversation, which has been difficult. And I wanted to kind of end on an uplifting note. And I'm wondering, as we move forward into difficult, stressful times, what sort of message of hope do you have?
I guess my main message of hope is that we have seen incredible progress from the scientific community on vaccines. And also, I think we will see them soon in treatments, from what I hear. And in addition to that, we actually know a lot more about this virus and a lot more about how to prevent it among ourselves, but also in our hospitals. So as scary as now is, we are in a much better position in my view than we were in the spring. And there is a light at the end of the tunnel. If you can, we're in for a tough couple of months. But I do think that we will, once the vaccine gets rolled out, we will feel like we're at the end of this rather than, just in the middle of it.
That was Karisten Konen, a professor of psychiatric epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages, at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.